The following podcast originally aired as part of an FM broadcast on WSUM 91.7 FM Madison on February 14th, 2024.
This is
Radio Resistance.
Hi everyone, you're tuned into WSUM 91.7 FM Madison, Wisconsin, and you're now listening to Radio Resistance. I'm your host, Surya Veer, aka DJ Sunray. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the program, Radio Resistance is a culture and art show where we touch on a new city, country, or region each week. Throughout our journey, in each episode, we'll share some interesting history, listen to some amazing music, share some fun facts, tell incredible stories, chat with friends, and much, much more. The common theme embedded into this radio show is, you guessed it, resistance. Our mission is to highlight stories and struggles that have taken place elsewhere to inspire all of us listening at home, while also introducing you to some unique music you may have never heard before. Hi everyone, happy Black History Month. I hope that you're all doing well and enjoying February. And I can't believe we're already halfway through the month, though not entirely because it's a leap year, I guess. But happy Valentine's Day, too. Make sure to tell everyone who's important in your life that you love them and all that. But today's episode of Radio Resistance is super special. I'm calling it our Black History Month special. Today, I wanted to take the chance in the next hour to highlight as many Black historical figures as I can, with the overall goal of introducing important figures who may not have gotten the deserved recognition in history class growing up. Now, I say this because every Black History Month, the spotlight is almost always on the same few iconic figures who championed civil rights in the 50s and 60s, such as Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, and Malcolm X, who all indelibly changed the course of history for the better. But still, there have been so many inspiring and pioneering Black figures throughout American history that I hadn't learned about until very recently. These are authors, inventors, physicians, journalists, entertainers, athletes, soldiers, diplomats, and much more. Black Americans helped build this country from the ground up in every industry, all while facing discrimination and abuses for centuries, inequities that still run large in today's USA. It's important to learn the stories of these amazing people who have the ability to further inspire future generations from their contributions decades ago. And I want to preface that I'm not an African American history scholar by any means. I simply just want to share these stories with you all. However, I do encourage everyone to seek out Black voices, not only online and in print, but also in our community. Speaking from personal experience, some of the most enriching ideas and stories I've heard have come from speakers at public events in the Madison area, and I hope that as many people as possible can take advantage of these opportunities. So, without further ado, let's get into today's episode by starting first with a brief history of Black History Month itself. Black History Month actually first had its humble origins as a Black History Week, which was created in 1926 in the U.S. when historian Carter G. Woodson and the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History declared the second week of February Negro History Week. This specific week was chosen because it already coincided with two dates that were widely celebrated within Black communities, the first being Abraham Lincoln's birthday on February 12th, and the second being Frederick Douglass's on February 14th, better known as today, where we celebrate his 206th birthday. Now, interestingly enough, Frederick Douglass chose his birthday to be the 14th of February, as there was no record of the exact day he was born. In one of his autobiographical narratives, titled My Bondage and My Freedom, he writes that he chose the 14th to be his birthday in remembrance of his mother lovingly calling him Little Valentine, which I think is quite sweet. Now, back to Negro History Week, it started as an effort by Woodson and other Black educators to promote the teaching of Black history throughout the public school systems. In its early years, it gained heavy support from African American newspapers and even received adoption by several states' departments of education. The week grew in popularity in the decades that followed as it was adopted by mayors of cities across the country, endorsing it as an official local holiday. It wasn't until Black educators and Black United students at Kent State University in Ohio proposed Black History Month in February of 1969 that the entire month was celebrated, although the first celebration of the designated month came a year later. The celebration swept over the country in educational institutions, community centers, and centers of Black culture nationwide. And 6 years later, it became federally recognized in 1976 when then-President Gerald Ford addressed the country during the celebration of the United States Bicentennial, where he urged Americans to, quote, recognize the important contribution made to our nation's life and culture by Black citizens, end quote. Now, to celebrate the legacy of Black History Month, I want to highlight some figures you may not have heard about who have indeed uplifted our nation through their contributions, starting with some prolific stories from early on in our country's history. I want to first start out by telling the story of a courageous woman from Massachusetts named Elizabeth Freeman, who became one of the first enslaved Black Americans to win their freedom through the courts, even before the United States Constitution was ratified. Elizabeth Freeman was born around 1744 in Claverack, New York, where she was given the name Bet by slave owner Peter Hogaboom. Hogaboom's daughter, Hannah, married John Ashley of Sheffield, Massachusetts. It was said that Elizabeth always exhibited a spirited sense of self throughout her life, as she often got into conflicts with Hannah Ashley. One time, Elizabeth even shielded another house servant from Hannah's striking with the hot shovel. This left a deep scar on her arm that she would keep uncovered to display the harsh treatment she faced as a slave. Now, I mentioned earlier that this Hannah Ashley was married to a certain John Ashley, who was a Yale-educated lawyer, a businessman, and a leader in the then colony of Massachusetts. In fact, many historians believe that John Ashley's house was the site where the Sheffield Declaration was signed 3 years before the Declaration of Independence. This declaration was similar to the one we are all more familiar with, in that it was critical of British policies in colonial America. Later, in 1780, Freeman was indirectly a party to the hearings on the newly ratified Massachusetts Constitution. It's unclear when or how Elizabeth Freeman overheard the points made in the Constitution, but their events deeply inspired her battle to secure freedom for herself. One such example can be seen in the first article of the Massachusetts State Constitution, that states, "All men are born free and equal, and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, in fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness." Now, does that sound a little familiar? Anyways, so in hearing about these unalienable rights bestowed to all, Elizabeth Freeman decided to take a stand. She enlisted the help of Theodore Sedgwick, who was a young abolition-minded lawyer, to help argue that the newly ratified constitutional provision should grant her freedom from slavery. In fact, in a later account from Sedgwick's daughter, Freeman told Theodore Sedgwick, "I heard that paper yesterday that says all men are created equal, and that every man has a right to freedom. I'm not a dumb critter. Won't the law give me my freedom?" After a great deal of consultation, Sedgwick finally accepted her case, as well as the case of Brom, who was another slave that Ashley owned. And the case of Brom and Bet versus Ashley was subsequently heard in August of 1781. Sedgwick and another lawyer, Tapping Reeve, who founded the Litchfield Law School, argued that the first article of the Massachusetts Constitution made slavery illegal, and the jury indeed found that their assessment was just, leading the court to impose a binding ruling that slavery in the state of Massachusetts is unconstitutional. Bet became the first free African-American woman in the state, and after the ruling, she worked as a governess to Theodore Sedgwick's children. After gaining her freedom, Elizabeth Freeman became widely appreciated for her skills as a healer and nurse. After the Sedgwick children grew up, Freeman moved to Stockbridge, Massachusetts, near her daughter, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. The great majority of information we have on Freeman's extraordinary story comes from an account written by Theodore Sedgwick's daughter, Catherine Sedgwick. Now, to give you another perspective, here's a cool clip from part of a project by the Museum of the American Revolution called Meet Elizabeth Freeman, starring Tiffany Bacon and written by Teresa Miller. This was part of the museum's 2021 exhibit, When Women Lost the Vote, A revolutionary story.
When a baby is born, it has so much hope in its eyes, a hope they don't even know. Teach yourself hope, even in the worst of circumstances. That's what I used to tell myself, not that anybody cared to hear my thoughts. But I always had hope. That's what got me by most days. I knew that if I hoped for a home and I saved my money, I'd have my own one day. But I hope for freedom first. Funny thing about the light. No matter how you catch it, whether it's in a glass or someone else's eyes or even a piece of jewelry, it's alive and free. Don't cost you nothing to look at it, and you can't punish it for going away at night. But the next day, it comes back like it has a job to do, and it does. At night when you can't see the light, it's off being alive and free somewhere else. I wondered if I would ever be free. I don't know when, but I know one day I want to get closer to the light.
The next story that I wanted to highlight today is that of Rebecca Lee Crumpler, the first Black woman in the United States to become a doctor. Rebecca Lee Crumpler was born Rebecca Davis on February 8, 1831 in Christiana, Delaware, to mother Matilda Weber and father Absalom Davis. She was raised in Pennsylvania by her aunt, who cared for the ill townspeople in her area. Her aunt was essentially the doctor in her community, and it was her influence that inspired Crumpler's decision to become a doctor. In 1853, she moved to Charlestown, Massachusetts, where she initially worked as a nurse before applying and being accepted to the New England Female Medical College, where she was the only Black student in the school. At the time of her acceptance into medical school in 1860, there were over 50,000 physicians in the United States, 300 of whom were women. Even more miraculous of a fact is that of that small 300, in 1864, Rebecca Lee Crumpler became the first Black woman formally trained as a physician in the country. Upon graduation, Crumpler began her practice in Boston, primarily caring for poor African American women and children. But after the Civil War ended, she moved to Richmond, Virginia, where she saw the ideal opportunity to serve a minority community and learn about diseases that affected women and children. In Virginia, Crumpler worked for the Freedmen's Bureau, providing medical care to those denied care by white physicians. The Freedmen's Bureau was a U.S. government agency that was part of the early post-Civil War Reconstruction effort to remedy the harrowing effects of the war on freed slaves and their families. While at the Bureau, Crumpler faced racism from both the administration and other doctors, as she was often ignored by her male counterparts. She later moved back to Boston in a predominantly African-American community in Beacon Hill, where she continued her practice, mostly treating children, even when their families were unable to afford care. In 1883, Crumpler published a book of medical discourses from the notes she kept throughout the course of her career as a physician. It was dedicated to nurses and mothers and highlighted the many preventative measures she had learned to protect women and children from disease. The book also contains non-medical advice and autobiographical accounts from her formation and practice as the first Black woman medical doctor in the United States. I'd like to take this chance to share an interesting quote from her book, where she talks about the progression of her life events leading up to her becoming a physician. She writes, "It may be well to state here that having been reared by a kind aunt in Pennsylvania, whose usefulness with the sick was continuously sought, I early conceived a liking for and sought every opportunity to relieve the sufferings of others. Later in life, I devoted my time, when best I could, to nursing as a business, serving under different doctors for a period of 8 years, most of the time at my adopted home in Charleston, Middlesex County, Massachusetts. From these doctors, I received letters commending me to the faculty of the New England Female Medical College, whence, 4 years afterwards, I received the degree of Doctoress of Medicine." Dr. Rebecca Lee Crumpler paved the way so early on for Black Americans to pursue medicine, and her story of resilience is one that has inspired generations of doctors to come. The next person we'll talk about on today's show is Black visionary photographer, composer, author, poet, and film director Gordon Parks. As you can see, he was a jack of many trades, but Parks was perhaps most famous for his photojournalistic contributions to the civil rights movement, and more broadly, for his documentation of poverty and struggle in African American communities from the 1940s to the 70s, through photos he published in Life magazine. Parks also famously broke the color barrier for directors in Hollywood by becoming one of the first Black American filmmakers to direct films in the industry. He popularized and helped create the film genre of blaxploitation, which is a response to Hollywood films that perpetuated stereotypes like crime. Blaxploitation became an idea of reshaping this narrative by employing Black crews and making films for Black audiences, though these films became popular internationally and ended up propelling Parks to fame nationally. His most famous movie was called Shaft, which told the story of a cool, snazzy, leather jacket-wearing Black private detective hired to find the kidnapped daughter of a Harlem gang member. Though perhaps most famous for his photography and films, which saw him bear many honors throughout his lifetime, what I find most inspirational about Gordon Parks' career was his courage to dive headfirst into whatever interested him. Parks opened the door for Black photographers and filmmakers through his work, but he never thought of stopping there. He was also a writer, painter, and music composer, with several published works in each of these realms. His legacy has inspired many other Black creatives. Director Spike Lee cites Parks as a major inspiration, stating, and I quote, "You get inspiration where it comes from. It doesn't have to be because I'm looking at his films. The odds that he got these films made when there were no Black directors is enough," end quote. Likewise, his photographs have inspired some of my favorite musical artists. One of his photographs, titled 1956 Alabama, is used on the album cover of Common's album Like Water for Chocolate. It portrays a young Black woman in Alabama drinking from a water fountain labeled Colored Only. Earlier on the show, we played a little segment of the instrumental from one of the tracks on that album, titled The Light. His work was also referenced in Kendrick Lamar's music video for Element, where many of his photographs are recreated by actors. Now, I want to allow Parks to speak for himself with this interview clip where he gives his advice to young Black people.
My advice to young Black people who want to do something is not to walk in with you, letting your Blackness weight you down. Look, you walk in saying, "I'm a fashion photographer, I'm a documentary photographer, I'm this or I'm that. Let's go to work." You know,
yes, not exactly.
Let these problems of being Black bog you down, because that's going to hurt you rather than help you.
That's right. Black is not a problem anyway,
no,
is it?
Problem.
Yes, of course not.
And it only made me work harder.
Yes.
The early days of racism only made me work all that much more. Just prove to the rest of the world that I could do this or I could do that.
Of course.
The first place, the first thing you have to have is desire. And then you have to have the courage to fulfill that desire. That's the thing about it. You should, I cannot let Blackness weigh you down, because if I did, I would forget about Madeline Murphy.
Yes, of course.
I would forget about Harvey Goldstein.
Yes.
Who lent me the cameras. I would forget about Alex Lieberman at Vogue.
That's true.
You know?
Yes, I do.
And so I cannot let that kind of thing stand in my way.
When we think of great American female singers, certainly a multitude of Black names come to the forefront. Nina Simone, Aretha Franklin, Etta James, Whitney Houston, and Beyoncé, just to name a handful. But before any of them ever took the stage, a woman named Ethel Waters was topping the U.S. charts as early as the 1920s. Ethel Waters started her singing career in Baltimore, where she sang at the Lincoln Theater, for what she recalled being a rich sum of $10 per week. She later moved all over the U.S., joining a wide variety of gigs, including joining a carnival traveling in freight cars, and working in a club in Atlanta. Around 1919, Waters moved to Harlem to become a performer in the burgeoning Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. The Harlem Renaissance was an intellectual and cultural era that saw a golden age of revival for African American music, dance, art, fashion, literature, theater, politics, and more. The core of this Renaissance was based in Harlem, the neighborhood connecting the boroughs of Manhattan and the Bronx in New York City. It was in Harlem that Ethel Waters' career really took off. She recorded under many different record labels, with her first hit, Dinah, being recorded in 1925. She even acted on Broadway in a multitude of roles. Waters would go on to have an illustrious career in music, theater, and film, although it certainly did not come easy. She faced racism throughout her career, from promoters holding out on payments to organizers not allowing her to perform at certain venues. Waters is considered to be the first singer to openly confront racism in a popular song with her 1933 hit Summertime. Shortly, I will play her song Stormy Weather, which was released later that same year. Waters was also only the second Black American ever to be nominated for an Academy Award for her supporting role in the 1949 film Pinky. Waters was a force in the entertainment industry, and the song Stormy Weather that I will play now was later covered and re-recorded by many notable artists in the years following its release. Let's see if you recognize some of these names. Billie Holiday, Judy Garland, Charles Mingus? Those don't ring a bell? Well, there's Duke Ellington and Frank Sinatra too. Moving forward with that theme is our next story of how love historically triumphed over discrimination with the story of the American couple of Mildred Dolores Loving and her husband, Richard Perry Loving. And no, I didn't make that up. Those are actually their last names. These two were the plaintiffs in the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case Loving v. Virginia, after the two of them were criminally charged with interracial marriage under a Virginia statute banning these marriages. Mildred identified as Black and Native American, specifically Rappahannock Indian, and Richard was European American and raised in Central Point, Virginia. Now, at the time of their marriage, interracial marriages were banned by Virginia's Racial Integrity Act of 1924, and upon returning to their shared home in Central Point, they were arrested by the county sheriff, who had received an anonymous tip. They pled guilty and were sentenced to 1 year in prison, with the sentence having the possibility of being suspended for 25 years, contingent on their leaving the state. So, they packed up and moved to Washington, D.C. They were fed up, however, with their inability to travel freely together to visit their families in Virginia. And after some family issues, they decided they needed to move back to Virginia, which meant filing a lawsuit against the state. Mildred Loving wrote to then-Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy about her situation, where she was referred to the American Civil Liberties Union, better known as the ACLU. The ACLU filed a motion on the Loving's behalf, citing that the state of Virginia's statutes banning interracial marriages violated the 14th Amendment. The case ultimately reached the Supreme Court, and the Lovings could not attend, but Richard Loving told his lawyer to convey this message to the court. He said, "Tell the court I love my wife, and it is just unfair that I can't live with her in Virginia." On June 12, 1967, the court unanimously sided in Loving's favor, and from that day forward set the precedent that interracial marriages were to be legal everywhere in the United States. The Lovings went on to have two children together and later were able to move back to Central Point, Virginia, where Richard built them a house that was to be their home for the rest of their lives together. Tragically, Richard was killed at age 41 in a car crash when a drunk driver struck the Lovings' car. This also caused Mildred to lose her right eye. Mildred died later in 2008 of pneumonia at age 68, and her daughter Peggy stated, "I wanted people to remember her as being strong and brave, yet humble and believing in love." So So that's all we've got for today's episode. I want to wish everyone a happy Valentine's Day and a happy Black History Month. I hope you enjoyed these stories of Black American figures who have changed the course of American history with their contributions, and I hope you learned something new. I encourage you to take the chance this month, and every month, honestly, to learn more about the contributions of African Americans to society. I want to thank you for listening to this week's episode, and we'll see you next time on
Radio Resistance. Swank.